Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Heidi Boghossian, former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, who assesses the record of outgoing U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder in areas including racial profiling, dragnet surveillance of U.S. citizens, and drone attacks targeting Americans abroad. Jason Fultz of the group Gainesville Loves Mountains, who talks about a landmark vote at a local Florida electric utility that will end their use of coal mined by the controversial mountaintop removal extraction method. And Connor Gibson, a researcher with Greenpeace, who discusses his group's report, Coke on Campus, Polluting Higher Education, which investigates the billionaire Koch brothers' investments in university research. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Tens of thousands of Hong Kong pro-democracy activists blocked downtown streets and pushed back riot police in a growing confrontation over new restrictions on upcoming elections imposed by top Chinese officials in Beijing. The student-led civil disobedience movement in Hong Kong has escalated demands for representative democracy in defiance of a government announcement in late August that all candidates for Hong Kong's chief executive in 2017 would first be approved by a pro-Beijing committee. An earlier mass student boycott set the stage for the current protests. The election rules handed down by Chinese officials make it virtually impossible for someone who has not demonstrated loyalty to the Beijing government to run in the election. The move toward direct elections in Hong Kong was part of an agreement signed prior to the 1997 transfer of the territory back to Chinese control. Hong Kong had been a British colony for more than 150 years. New student activists and the more established Occupy Central with Love and Peace movement are calling for full democratic reform and the resignation of Hong Kong's leader, Leung Chun-ying. China's president, Xi Jinping, is under growing pressure to act against the Hong Kong protests to prevent pro-democracy demonstrations from spreading to other regions like Tibet. The national furor over the killing of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, focused public attention on police abuse of minority youth. In Chicago, activists mobilized in reaction to the police killing of 19-year-old Rashad McIntosh. As in Ferguson, community activists demanded authorities release the name of the police officer involved in McIntosh's death. Activists say McIntosh was unarmed and kneeling when he was shot to death. The shooting on Chicago's impoverished West Side increased longstanding community police tensions. Beyond the McIntosh shooting, tensions remained high as prosecutors charged a police commander on the West Side for holding a gun down a man's throat and threatening to kill him in a 2013 incident. According to an investigation by the Chicago Reporter newspaper, black residents in the city are 10 times as likely to be shot by police as whites. According to the news magazine In These Times, over the violent July 4th holiday weekend, 5 people were shot by police, resulting in 2 deaths. Activists, including many newly involved youth, are campaigning for a law establishing an elected civilian police review board with independent investigative powers. 4 years after Jacksonville, Florida resident Kelly Young received a home foreclosure letter from Bank of America, Young got another notice informing her that her disability payments and Medicare benefits had been cut off. The Social Security Administration accused her of lying on her application when she failed to disclose that she owned a house. But as far as Young knew, she didn't own a house. After receiving the letter from Bank of America, she left her home without a fight. The problem is, Bank of America never followed through on the foreclosure. Young's house now sits empty, strewn with trash and a leaky roof, collecting fines for code violations and unpaid taxes related to the delinquent mortgage. With the help of a legal aid lawyer, it took Young 5 months to get her benefits restored. Young's case is not unique. As the Center for Public Integrity reports, Jacksonville's poor neighborhoods are dotted with abandoned houses stuck in foreclosure limbo. The so-called zombie properties are often uninhabitable because they've fallen into disrepair, and owners are unwilling to invest in fixing them up because, with the mortgage unpaid, the bank can always come back and foreclose again. In record-breaking agreements with the Justice Department to settle claims of mortgage bond fraud, Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase each agreed to contribute to efforts to fight blight, including forgiving loans when they decide not to pursue foreclosure and helping cities pay to demolish homes. The agreements, however, contain no specific monetary obligation and instead fall under broad consumer relief payments. The housing collapse in Florida has largely left cities to clean up the mess. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
In a surprising shakeup within the Obama administration, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced on September 25th that he will resign his post as soon as a successor can be nominated and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Holder, the first African-American attorney general in U.S. history, has been a lightning rod for Republican Party criticism on many issues, including the government's handling of the Fast and Furious gun trafficking sting operation. This resulted in Holder being the first attorney general held in contempt by the U.S. House of Representatives. While conservatives and GOP politicians will be happy to see Holder leave government, many progressive activists have a mixed view of his record. On issues such as defending what was left of the Voting Rights Act, gutted by a 2013 Supreme Court ruling, opening the door to federal recognition of same-sex marriage, challenging mandatory minimum drug sentencing and confronting police abuse and racial profiling in communities of color, Holder has been widely praised as an attorney general like no other. But on issues such as dragnet warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens, drone attacks targeting Americans abroad, and aggressive prosecution of government whistleblowers and harassment of journalists, Eric Holder is viewed by many on the left as having institutionalized many of the repressive policies and executive powers first invoked by President George W. Bush. Your reporter spoke with Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute, who formerly led the National Lawyers Guild. Here she assesses the legacy of outgoing U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder.
I do think it's a mixed bag, and if we start with some of the positive gains, we know that the federal and the local prison populations have seen a decrease for the first time in several decades. And I think that Holder has definitely played a role in that, especially with a reduction in mandatory sentencing for nonviolent drug offenses, something that we've been living with for years and that's really torn apart communities across this nation. We've seen gains for the LGBT community, finally, with the right to marry for gay and lesbian couples. That's been a wonderful development. And we've also seen the Justice Department conduct several investigations into police departments across the country where there have been tensions between black communities and primarily white police forces. And the work in supporting the Voting Rights Act, those are all wonderful things that I think we can say Holder played an important role in. However, I would say that the body of his record and legacy with respect to civil rights and a failure to go after white-collar crime when we've had really the worst recession in many decades, with tens of millions of people thrown out of work, losing their homes, has been a blight on his record. His blatant failure to go after Wall Street, the banks, the individuals responsible for this. I think that sends a message that corporations get a free pass no matter what damage they bring to this country.
Heidi, what specifically was Attorney General Eric Holder's role in the Obama administration's decision to target U.S. citizens abroad with drone strikes for the purpose of assassination? Was he someone deeply involved in making these decisions and the legal arguments to rationalize them?
Well, the Department of Justice is involved in those decisions, and your listeners may remember the so-called torture memos from the Bush administration, sometimes called the Bybee or the interrogation opinions, where the Attorney General's office drafted legal memoranda essentially justifying waterboarding and other forms of torture. So that all of these things are integral to the Department of Justice. And I may add that the Holder Attorney General's office failure to prosecute any of those Bush administration officials for torture is yet another stain on his record, because Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and ex-CIA Director George Tenet authorized torture and other war crimes. And I think that would have been an opportunity to make up for some of the outrages of the prior administration.
Heidi, long after Eric Holder is gone from government, the Bush administration and Obama administration policies on dragnet surveillance, harsh prosecution of government whistleblowers, and attacks on journalists will have set an important precedent. In your mind, what can be done, what should be done in terms of reversing course here now that these precedents have been set? Do we have a chance as a country to reclaim some of our civil liberties and constitutionally guaranteed freedoms?
I think there's hope that the public starts to see that we are supposed to have an open press, that we're not supposed to threaten journalists, especially with criminal sanctions, just for sharing stories that really can benefit the public to know. So I'm hopeful that with increased independent journalism and research and public, perhaps, sympathy for some of the individuals who have made a decision to risk arrest or really know that the rest of their lives they may be penalized for coming forth with information they think we have a right to know. Hopefully there will be a shift in public sentiment and viewing these people as patriots rather than what the government would call them as criminals, and see that there's a need to bring this information into the public forum, and that a government that's afraid of its citizens knowing that is not a government that really works for the people and has our best interest at heart. So I continue to believe that individuals, by seemingly small and sometimes not so small actions, such as the ones Ed Snowden took, can make a huge difference in how we reverse what may seem at times to be a very depressing trend that this country has taken. I still believe in the hope of communities and activists and people who stand up and say, no, this isn't right. You know, I don't want a drone surveilling my little town, or I don't want to have a biometric ID scanner when I go to the doctor, things like that.
That was Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute, who formerly led the National Lawyers Guild. She's author of the book Spying on Democracy. Find more perspectives on the legacy of outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Many forms of extreme energy extraction are employed in the United States, like deep ocean oil drilling or horizontal fracturing or fracking for natural gas. Among the oldest and most destructive practices is mountaintop removal coal mining, where the tops of mountain ridges in Appalachia are literally blown off to mine the coal seams, resulting in the waste rock and earth being dumped into the valleys below, often burying headwater streams. Opponents of mountaintop removal mining point to the studies that have linked this mining process to health problems like cancer and cardiovascular disease. Local Appalachian residents have been fighting the mining practice for decades, and a recent decision by a publicly owned electric utility in Gainesville, Florida, demonstrates how others around the country can take action to support their drive to end mountaintop removal coal mining. A 3.5-year-long campaign to end the Gainesville Regional Utility's use of coal mined by removing mountaintops was victorious on September 18th, when the City Commission voted 5-2 to adopt a policy that will pay up to 5% more to buy coal that is not mined using mountaintop removal methods. This is the first policy of its kind in the nation to be passed by a municipally owned utility. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jason Foltz, co-founder of the group Gainesville Loves Mountains, who talks about how this local victory was won and his hope that other communities will follow Gainesville's example.
We were inspired by the national movement to end mountaintop removal coal mining. a lot of folks in Gainesville have connections to Appalachia and are familiar with the issue, and an awful lot more people know and love Appalachia, you know, as a region. And so as they've learned about mountaintop removal, they've just been horrified. And we're a pretty progressive community that is thinking a lot about energy issues. And so an awful lot of people in the Gainesville community didn't want us to be connected in any way to the practice of mountaintop removal. So we've been working for about 3.5 years now to end our utilities purchases of coal that's mined using mountaintop removal.
What body exactly voted to nix mountaintop removal coal?
Well, we have a municipally owned utility, and so our city commission is essentially the board of our utility. And so we've been having conversations with the utility for the past 3.5 years on this issue, and it basically just, you know, hit a dead end with them. And their bottom line was that we're only pursuing reliable, low-cost fuels. We're agnostic with regard to the source of those fuels. If you want to have any further policy direction on this matter, then you're going to need to go to the city commission. So that's what we did. We went and convinced our city commission to issue a policy directive on mountaintop removal coal.
And they agreed to pay a premium for non-mountaintop removal coal, right?
Right. So the policy preferences deep mine coal from Appalachia and says that it allows our fuel purchasers to pay up to a 5% premium to buy deep mine coal and avoid the purchase of surface mine or mountaintop removal coal.
Jason Foltz, I've covered this issue for several years, and I've never heard of a utility voting to not use mountaintop removal coal. Is Gainesville the first?
That's what we believe to be true. We've been working very closely with Appalachian Voices, which is a regional issue and is in the forefront of the fight against mountaintop removal coal. And they are aware of policies that have been passed in other instances. For instance, Duke Energy has a stated policy on the topic of mountaintop removal coal, although it's pretty weak. There have been some colleges and universities that have their own coal-fired power plants that have passed policies. But this is by far the most progressive policy that we're aware of and the first that's been passed by a municipal utility. And so we're optimistic that if the word gets out about this, hopefully some other municipally owned utilities that are consuming mountaintop removal coal will try and follow our lead on this.
Is it hard to find out what the source is of the energy a particular utility uses?
No, it's not hard at all, actually. On two fronts. One is that your utility is required to report to the Department of Energy on a regular basis exactly what fuels they're buying and where those fuels are coming from, down to oftentimes a specific mine. And so the folks at Appalachian Voices, they created a really great resource that I highly recommend people check out called ilovemountains.org. And what you can do with that website, you can actually type in your zip code and it'll show you the utility providers for your area, and you can pick your utility provider, and it'll show you down to the mine where your coal is coming from and tell you not only if you're connected to the practice of mountaintop removal, but it'll tell you some of the stories of people that live in those communities that are being impacted. So it's a fantastic resource, and that's really one of the kind of things that inspired us to start working on this.
So I just have to ask you, this seems like a step in the right direction. But on the other hand, your utility is still using coal, which has the worst local impacts of any form of energy when burned, and arguably also contributes the most to global warming. What about getting off coal entirely?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. You know, I mean, we would definitely like to see our utility off of coal entirely eventually, and I'm pretty confident that that'll happen within the next 5 to 10 years. So some of the things that our utility has been doing is really progressive on this front. We've been diversifying our fuel supply. We used to be, like a lot of Florida utilities, heavily, heavily dependent upon coal as our primary fuel source. And our coal consumption has actually been dropping pretty significantly, largely due to the natural gas boom. But we're also diversifying our fuel supply in the areas of biomass and solar as well in Gainesville pretty significantly. We were the first utility in the country, I believe, to pass a solar feed-in tariff. So we've actually got an awful lot of solar in Gainesville as well, and are trying to move more and more in that direction. So, like I said, I'm hopeful that we're going to be off of coal entirely before too long. But in the meantime, we felt like it was a step in the right direction to try and eliminate what we consider to be the worst of the worst fuel sources from our mix.
That was Jason Foltz, co-founder of the Florida group Gainesville Loves Mountains. For more information on groups working to end mountaintop removal coal mining and phase out the use of coal nationwide, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The massive September 21st People's Climate March in New York City and dozens of other cities and towns around the globe sent an unmistakable message to world leaders that a growing majority of the planet's population are concerned about the destructive power of climate change and want governments to take substantive action. However, while many nations have set targets for reducing carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases that cause global warming, the United States government has been virtually unresponsive to the urgent call by a majority of the world's scientists that imposing new regulations on industry are essential if we are to avoid global climate collapse. One major obstacle to passing legislation in Washington that would address climate change is the nation's fossil fuel industry, which uses their money and influence to prevent the passage of new regulations while promoting research that claims climate change science is a myth or exaggerates the dangers we face. One of the most active family-owned corporations opposing action on climate change are Kansas billionaires Charles and David Koch, owners of Koch Industries. The Kochs have given tens of millions of dollars to groups that deny climate change science, undermine policy solutions to the problem, and attack subsidies for clean energy while preserving handouts to fossil fuel companies. The activities of the Koch brothers, who are heavily investing in university research, is the focus of a new report from the environmental group Greenpeace, titled Koch on Campus, Polluting Higher Education. Your reporter spoke with Connor Gibson, a researcher with the Greenpeace investigation team, who summarizes some of the key findings of his group's Koch on Campus report.
Basically, in my research on Koch Industries and its billionaire owners, Charles and David Koch, as they fund groups that deny the science of climate change or block policies and regulations to solve the problem, it became impossible to ignore some of their political activity on campus. Listeners might remember that in 2011, Florida State University had a controversy around the Charles Koch Foundation giving a multi-million dollar grant, and it came with strings attached where they had veto power over certain professors that were nominated for the positions Charles Koch was funding and, you know, indirect control over the type of curriculum that would be advanced. And that has since been proven and reproven in a series of leaked emails and whistleblower professors. But there's a much larger mission by Charles Koch in particular to infiltrate the higher education system. My research suggests he has funded about 250 universities to a total of $50 million since 2005, with the majority of that happening in recent years. Back in 2005, Charles Koch is only funding 7 schools, and at this point, he's funding about 250, according to their website. So schools like George Mason University in Virginia, Florida State University, Clemson in South Carolina, West Virginia University, these are all schools that are very heavily funded by Charles Koch, and what we've seen from certain contracts suggests a dire threat to academic freedom. You know, if the Charles Koch Foundation has any say in what professors are hired, whether it's a wink-wink agreement or whether it's explicitly written into the contract, that's entirely inappropriate, according to experts of academic freedom. So to me, this is an extension of our research on Koch Industries' pollution of the environment into their pollution of educational curriculum.
Connor, I wanted to ask you about differentiating legitimate funding for academic research and the kinds of research that you exposed in this report, Koch Pollution on Campus. Certainly, you can have conservative or liberal or folks in the middle politically who do fund academic research that they have sympathies with. But what is it that you see different here with the Koch brothers that you feel crosses the line between legitimate academic research by disinterested parties and what the Kochs are doing?
Yeah, there are a few red flags that come with the Koch grants. And this is very much consistent with Charles Koch's reputation as being very astute with his investments. He expects a return on the things that he's investing in, and that appears to be true with universities. As far back as 1974, we have a speech from Charles Koch as the chairman of a group called the Institute for Humane Studies. Now, that's a group he still chairs, and it's one of the two groups I mentioned on the campus of George Mason University. In this speech in 1974, Charles Koch made it very clear that they should, business leaders should only be funding academic institutions that are willing to carry forward broad business interests. And that seems to be exactly what he's done in the contracts that the Charles Koch Foundation has signed with these economics departments and business departments mostly. They're written in certain code words for teaching the kind of the ideology that has made Charles Koch as rich as he is. Things like economic freedom, those words are actually written into the contract with Clemson University in South Carolina. Economic freedom is a political concept that Koch-funded think tanks, the Heritage Foundation in D.C. and the Fraser Institute in Canada, they measure economic freedom around the world, and it tends to correlate with countries that have lax labor laws and low regulations and low taxes on corporations, things that, you know, Charles Koch favors. And this is what Clemson professors are supposed to be teaching if they're funded by Charles Koch. So that is certainly a red flag, and you don't need to take Greenpeace's word for it. I would say defer to the American Association of University Professors. They're kind of a clearinghouse on the concept of academic freedom and, you know, are willing to validate that these grants from the Koch Foundation have put academic freedom in the crosshairs.
Connor, maybe you can go into some of the important debates that have developed on campus relating to Koch funding. Has there been a backlash among students who are becoming aware through your report and other sources that the Koch brothers are influencing the curriculum of their education?
Concerned professors and students at Florida State University first started making a big deal about this in 2011 when the contract was reviewed by the Faculty Senate and they found that it was inappropriate. And that became a major media story that is actually resurfacing this year. Students actively are working to limit the influence of the Charles Koch Foundation at their school in Florida State. But there are other schools that have been vocal about this too. In fact, all fairly recently, George Mason University students just wrote a letter to their president asking for a meeting, asking for transparency to be provided about the contracts between Koch and their school because they don't know what kind of control Charles Koch might have at George Mason. But he does operate two think tanks at George Mason University that are, you know, they were founded by the Kochs and their fellow executives at Koch Industries, as well as other schools. Kansas University, I read, is now calling for transparency on its agreement with the Koch brothers. And just this year, the City University of New York in Brooklyn rejected a multi-million dollar offer from the Koch brothers because they were afraid of this kind of control.
That was Connor Gibson, a researcher with the Greenpeace Investigations team, which compiled the group's new report titled Koch on Campus, Polluting Higher Education. Find a link to the Greenpeace report and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.